Hello and welcome to the history of Bangalore. I am your host, Ramji Chandran, and let me remind you that we are in season one, the early history, the centuries before Kempe Gowda established the modern city of Bangalore. Today we look at two of the battles for Bangalore, one the battle for Hebbal and the other the battle of Tumbepadi. These battles took place almost a couple of centuries apart. Tumbepadi was sometime in the end of the 9th or beginning of the 10th century, say before 910 AD, and Hebbal was much older, sometime before 750 AD. Both these battles were discovered on inscription, hero stones or Biragallus, that commemorate the fallen heroes of battle. I picked these two battles to talk about today, first because the inscriptions define them as real battles and not skirmishes on account of some provincial enmity or cattle thievery. Next, because of how evocative their inscriptions and how interesting their heroes. And not the least, because in their stories is buried the larger story that connects us, you and me, with the early history of Bangalore. The inscription, sometimes called the Begur inscription, commemorating the Battle of Tumbepadi, was first made public in a photograph taken by a Major Henry Dixon of the Madras Native Infantry stationed in the Bangalore cantonment. We encountered him in our earlier episode, How We Discovered the History of Bangalore. The scope and scale of this inscription is such that it is often discussed as a work of historical art, as indeed I will later in this episode with researcher historian Anirudh Kanisetty. The Hebbal inscription came to public ken recently, around 2018, when it was saved from being buried under roadworks when an alert Hebbal resident called in Dr. Rajin Rupatunga and his team from the Revival Heritage Hub, a non-profit, and the man who deciphered the inscription, historian and epigraphist Dr. P.V. Krishnamurthy. And I will now talk about these battles, but before I do, I must take pause and acknowledge with my gratitude the Prestige Group, whose support makes this podcast possible. Building cities one landmark at a time, they transform dreams into reality. You can be a part of the future. Simply add prestige to your life. And now, the Battle of Hebbal. We know it happened in the 8th century, and we know that it was in the town of Hebbal, at the time known by its original, or at least older, phonological variant, Periyapural, or Big Town. Over the years, epigraphists say that it became Perbolal, and then got shortened to Pebbal and finally Hebbal. In the 8th century, Hebbal was a very important town. Like Begur that we discussed in our last episode, Hebbal was at the junction of important trade routes, important enough to become a target for marauders. And in the case of Hebbal, the attackers were a force sent by the Rashtrakutas, who were in constant battle with the Western Gangas. In Hebbal, Rashtrakuta forces set upon the town with a mission, Ur Alibu, which translates to wipe the town from the face of the earth. It was common practice for armies to plunder the lands they attack, steal the cattle, the major asset of the day, pillage the women, and cause as much destruction as they could in their wake. Ur Alibu in this case might have been the mission given the enmity between the Rashtrakutas and the Gangas, and therefore the desire of the Rashtrakutas to cause damage and loss to the Gangas when and where they could. One day, the Rashtrakutas attacked Hebbal, and it caused the death of a man fighting to defend his town, a man called Kittaya. We don't know very much about the scope and scale of this battle, and the only source of its history is the sculpted image in a few lines carved upon the hero stone. But we can tell that the Rashtrakutas were not entirely successful in their mission, as Hebbal still exists today and thrives. And someone lived to tell the tale and carved it upon a stone. And here's what the stone says. When Sri Purusha Maharaja was ruling the earth, Pill Nagatarasa was administering Perumbulool Nadu. Kittaya, the brother-in-law of Arakomara of Kodandale clan, attained Indraloka in an Ooralivu battle during a Ratavadi attack. The stone was installed by Perugundi and his brother Kirugundi. This stone must be considered as history and not local news such as the cattle raid, for all the reasons implicit on the stone. First, the art on the stone shows a warrior depicted in a pose with the sword raised to strike, this is probably Kittaya, and the other figure is an attacker on a horse. The horse is an indication that there was cavalry involved in this attack and therefore not a cattle raid. Cavalry and horses were the preserve of organized armies and not generally available for the convenience of cattle thieves. Next, let's break down the text. The mention of Sri Purusha dates the stone. Sri Purusha was a Ganga king who ruled between 726 and 788 AD. The stone mentions the local chieftain of Perumbulool Nadu, Pill Nagatarasa, and then mentions the hero Kittaya and his relationship to some known people in the area. It says, Kittaya attained Indraloka, which means he died honorably in the Ooralivu during the Ratavadi attack. Ratavadi is a reference to the Rashtrakutas. This much of history in the brevity of a mere 25 words in the old Kannada script and one image. The Revival Heritage Hub team of historian Rajiv Drupatunga rescued the stone, and today it sits on the site in Hebbal in a mantapa built in the style and method used by the Gangas in the 8th century. The question is, why is this significant to our history? And the answer lies in the politics and commercial landscape of the day. Let me paint you a picture. While most villages in medieval times in the region would have been predictably pastoral, with really nothing much happening, Hebbal was different because it was a trade junction and, like most such towns on the trade routes, must have been hopping. People from all over India, even from different parts of West Asia and Europe, would have made pit stops in junctions like Hebbal and Begur because the region around Bangalore is situated on the overland route between the east and the west coasts of the south. Even in the centuries before the medieval period, going as far back as the 1st century AD even, this overland route was popular. We know this by the 1st century AD Roman coins that we unearthed in Bangalore years later. In its time, there was great trade and Roman ships carrying gold arrived in the Kerala port of Muziris and left, departing with treasures such as spices and silks. But the crews on these ships could not simply leave as soon as their work was done. They needed to stay for months until they could catch a favorable trade wind to get them a safe passage back home. Many stayed for years. And in the wake of the ships and the commerce came merchants and manufacturers and tradesmen and lawyers and accountants, many of whom lived and worked and indeed married in India and would travel on work to important centers in the south, like Arikamedu and Tamil Nadu, for example. While we will go deeper into all of that in a future episode, it is easy to imagine junctions like Hebbal bustling with a diverse mix of multi-ethnic people, merchants, scholars, pilgrims, philosophers. And because of all this trade and commerce, the kingdoms of the south became tremendously powerful. Large empires included the Chalukyas, the Rashtrakutas, the Cholas, the Hoysalas, Vijayanagar, to name some of the majors. They understood scale and governance, and through delegation, they ruled their territory through a system of vassals and feudatories who were all powerful potentates holding court over the provinces they controlled, and these provincial leaders would swear allegiance to the dynasties to whom they were loyal. While the vassals were revenue and tax collectors and municipal administrators, what makes it to the front page of history is usually war and battle. And one of the most important roles of the feudatory was to become a military ally. So they raised and maintained armies, first of all to defend their own lands, but they could, and frequently would, be called upon to fight someone that the ruler of the empire wanted to fight, by whatever motivation, for whatever principal or profit, but these orders would be complied with no matter the cost. And this brings us to our battles. The Western Gangas, who were central to the early history of Bangalore, were a dynasty for a very long time, about 650 years, between 350 AD and about 1000 AD. Their territory was called the Gangavadi. Originally, they were the feudatories and allies of the Badami Chalukyas, and they were connected to them by marriage, and they were all happy in-laws. But in time, the once dominant Chalukya Empire that had ruled for centuries under the likes of the illustrious Pulakeshi II was beginning to show cracks, and the Rashtrakutas, another Chalukya feudatory, were quick to exploit this. There was much to exploit. There was internal strife in the Chalukya camp, and Danti Durga, the leader of the Rashtrakutas, convinced several of the Chalukya feudatories to abandon their alliance and accept him as their new overlord. By 753 AD, under the reign of Kirtivarman II, the Chalukya Empire fell to the Rashtrakutas, and the Rashtrakuta was now the new empire. But with the Chalukyas out of the picture, who would control Gangavadi? None of this sat well with the Gangas and their current leader, Sri Purusha. They had considered the Chalukyas as family and refused to accept the Rashtrakutas as their overlords. And this resulted in a standoff that lasted over a century. The Rashtrakutas, hungry for complete domination, had set their sights, their hearts and their minds on the strategically important Gangavadi, but the Gangas were unwilling to simply bow down, and they put up a fight. Despite the size and the military might of the Rashtrakutas, they were unable to bring the indomitable Gangas to heel. There are theories that despite their smaller size, the Gangas could not be overcome through brute force, because they understood the lie of the land and they knew how to defend themselves. So the Rashtrakutas took to attacking the Ganga assets and strongholds when they could. From inscriptions we learn that there were battles and skirmishes around the mid-8th century between them, and what we can surmise is that the battle for Hebbal was one such attack. The strain in the relationship did not last forever though, as finally the Rashtrakutas, probably realizing the futility of protracted war, adopted a more diplomatic approach, a marriage alliance, the time-tested tool in the statecraft toolkit. And it might have been Ganga Prince Putuga I, who, through his marriage to Chandra Balabbe, daughter of the powerful Amoghavarsha I, brought about the peace that had eluded the sides for so long, probably for 5 generations. By accepting the Rashtrakuta overlordship, the Ganga secured a powerful ally, and by dint of their new relationship, were able to maintain their autonomy in their internal affairs, and the memory of that fateful attack on Hebbal was forgotten in friendship and consigned to an inscription stone that came to public knowledge 1,200 years after our hero Kithaya fell in the Battle of Hebbal. And now for the Battle of Tumbepadi. As a feudatory of the Gangas, the Begur chieftain Nagatara received an order from his overlord, the king of the Gangas, Erenga Nitimarga II, or Ereyappa. We have heard of Nagatara in several episodes before, and this might be his last appearance on our show before we move on. The message that the faithful Nagatara received was clear. Gather your armies and go to Tumbepadi to help Ayappa Deva fight the king Biramahendra. Tumbepadi is the place presently known as Tumbadi. Tumbadi is northeast of Tumkur and is a little over 100 kilometers from Begur, where Nagatara was based. A person walking non-stop in the present day would walk about 24 hours to make the distance. Back then, with Nagatara taking an entire army to battle with horses and weapons and supplies, the journey would have taken much longer, several days probably. This march to Tumbepadi would be Nagatara's last. He died in the battle, trampled under the feet of an elephant. In Tumbepadi is a beautiful and large lake. The sun sets on the lake, are the subject of many photographs today. The lake is called Tumbadi Tank, but a little hamlet close by is called Chikkasagara, a small sea, and this might have something to do with the real name of it. The scenic beauty of Tumbepadi belies the horror of the day of that particular battle, for this was no ordinary battle. As one can learn from the sculpting on the inscription commemorating the Battle of Tumbepadi, this was a battle fought with elephants and horses, and with archers, swordsmen, lancers, and cavalry. One can see a man with the medieval Indian equivalent of a bugle, a feature only of major battles. And the scene of the battle itself is bloody and violent. Soldiers lie killed and scattered around the battlefield. On one side, a soldier examines a head that he has just severed. In another place, a demon spirit, you can tell by his tongue sticking out in an attempt to look fearsome and ugly, is standing upon fallen foot soldiers to harvest their souls, presumably. The elephant on which Bira Mahindra rides has an upside-down Ganga soldier in its trunk, but the poor elephant has 7 arrows embedded in its forehead. Its sides are cut and bleeding, and its tusks are bloody, indicating that it gored people. It is under an elephant, maybe this one, that Nagatara met his end. And a panel on top of the stone depicts a garlanded Nagatara in heaven being fanned and tended to by young naked maidens as his reward for his bravery and sacrifice. The artist or sculptor who worked on this hero stone was clearly moved by the events of the Battle of Tumbepadi, moved enough to create what has come to be known as one of the greatest inscriptions in India. Even in 1900, this stone inscription found mention in the all-important Epigraphia Indica. As well, it has come to the attention of both historians and art historians. The Begur Tumbepadi stone is unusual for several reasons. First, its size. It measures 6.5 feet across, and it is a shade under 7 feet tall. And on it is this inscription. Be it well, when a spotless moon in the sky, the Ganga Kula praised in all the world, the self-chosen lord of the Lakshmi of sovereignty of the earth, decorated at her waist with a zone of the wide circle of the waters of the ocean, his greatness adorned with the ornament of these and a host of countless virtues, Srimadariyappa, having made all his enemies powerless, was ruling the Gangavadi 96,000 under the shadow of one umbrella. On ordering Nagatara, along with his feudatories and the army, to Ayappa Deva in order to fight against Bira Mahindra, fighting in Tumbepadi, when the battle was losing ground, going close among the elephants, he slew and died. Hearing that, Ayappa was pleased and binding the Nagatara crown on Iruga, gave him the Bempur 12, secured by a sasana as a kalnad. Those are as follows: Bempuru, Thovaguru, Puvina Pulimangala, Nalluru, Koramagundu, Iggaluru, Ganajbagilu, Saramu, Elkunde, Paravuru, and Kudal. Thus, much with the fields and boundaries did Ayappa give for the dutiful Nagatara, great good fortune. Of these 12 villages that were gifted to Nagatara's son, Iruga, in gratitude by the Ganga King Ayappa, we were able to identify some of them. Bempur is Begur. Igalur still exists by the same name, south of Begur. Puvina Pulimangala is probably the modern-day Hulimangala. Thovaguru is today Thogur in the electronic city zone. And Kudal is Kudalu, which Bangaloreans might know by the Kudalu Gate. And now to who Bira Mahindra was. While in our previous episode, we quoted the historian M.B. Krishna Rao in his book Gangas of Talakad, identifying the Bira Mahindra in the inscription as the arch-nemesis of Ayappa, there are historians who dispute this theory, pointing out that the timelines of the battle do not match with the death of Bira Mahindra as it is known. So they say that the Bira Mahindra in Tumbepadi was someone else, probably an eastern Chalukya king. Still, the Battle of Tumbepadi marked the end of Nagatara, a man who found mention in several inscriptions, not only for his valor and his apparent devotion to duty, but also for his public works and his dedication to the town of Begur, where he built temples, water tanks, and irrigation canals, and indeed one day gave up his life as its chieftain. And his work, for the reasons that we mentioned in previous episodes, remains something of significance to Bangalore to this day. It is wondrous to think of these two battles and their fallen heroes, Kittaya from Hebbal and Nagatara from Begur. Men who laid down their lives in what could only be the most honorable death of its time, dying in an effort to protect their cities. Cities that are now significant neighborhoods of Bangalore. And now joining me are three historians, Dr. Rajiv Nrupatunga, who helped save the Hebbal stone, Dr. P.V. Krishnamurthy, who deciphered it, and Anirudh Kanisetty, with whom I will discuss the art of the Begur stone, right after this.
Prestige Group brings to you its latest launch, Prestige Somerville. Lake-facing 3 and 4 bed apartments on Marathahalli, Whitefield Road. For more details, call 85489-85489. Project is RERA approved.
Joining me now is Dr. Rajiv Nrupatunga, historian and founder of the Revival Heritage Hub, a non-profit. Rajiv, welcome to your first appearance on the history of Bangalore.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Now, you and your team were instrumental in saving the Kittaya stone, and it seems like quite the story.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us?
We got a message in a messenger, save the stones, by one particular person called as Dilip. And I was shocked, literally, what is the save the stones? So initially, my students went on the spot and they saw one small hero stone and the 16th century one inscription and two Yantrarakallu, they call. So that is for keeping for the good wish for the village. Mm-hmm. Initially, there was a road filling in the BBMP. They took out that stones and there was a road filling. They were supposed to fill it or throw it, that stones. Okay.
Right.
So literally, I went there and stopped BBMP people and they were against me. Mm-hmm. Literally against me. We have got a contract. We can't stop this work and all. Immediately, I went to archaeology department and Dr. Gopal was director there. I took a letter from him. Sir, uh-huh. Please support me, give a letter. He gave me the letter. What Mr. Gopal said, it is only by the villagers' support you can do. You can give a letter, we can give a permission.
Right.
But by the villagers' support only, you can go ahead.
Right.
Then we made all villagers to sit. I told them everything, we explained. Then literally, they all put the signatures. Okay. Then I spoke to my students on June 20, I think 2018, it was Saturday. Hmm. 3 o'clock we went there.
You went there with proper equipment and what resources did you have?
Literally nothing, no equipments, nothing. There was some building constructing there. We mm-hmm. took all this, whatever the tools, everything, we got it. Mm-hmm. Then we started at 3 o'clock. Then initially first 16th century stone was lifted. Then two Yantrarakallus were lifted. Mm-hmm. At last, at time of 6 o'clock, this stone was lifting. Then two of my students stayed whole night there. Do you believe or not, sir? That was the case. Then it was completely deciphered by P.V. Krishnamurthy. Then from Mysore Archaeological Department, people also came. They also took a copy. Later, issue was created was to reinstall that. Later, Uday Kumar, he joined this movement with some funds, everything, and they constructed one.
Of the Mythic Society inscription team.
Yeah. So later they constructed one mantapa for
Yashaswini Sharma.
She was the architect of that.
This is good.
Great, sir. Great.
Congratulations on all the work, Rajiv. And I hope that I can get you back on the show as often as is necessary.
Sure, Ramji, sir. Sure. My pleasure.
And now for Dr. P.V. Krishnamurthy, epigraphist, historian, and the man who deciphered the Kittaya stone. Welcome to the show, Dr. Krishnamurthy.
Okay, thank you, sir.
So when they found the Kittaya inscription stone, they got in touch with you. What did you find?
Immediately after seeing the WhatsApp photo, I'm surprised. The old scripts are very old. Then I find that Sri Purusha name is also, it is 8th century. That's I'm very happy. In our Bangalore region, this is one of the old inscriptions.
Your interpretation of the stone reveals the enmity between the Gangas and the Rashtrakutas. Is there much more evidence of this?
In Chumara's period, it is very common the war between the Rashtrakutas and the Gangas. Not only here, around Bangalore, 2-3 inscriptions are there. So, yeah, it's the same about Rashtrakutas.
And after Amoghavarsha brought the two camps together, you mentioned that Gangas helped the Rashtrakutas in their campaigns.
In the period of after Amoghavarsha, they are relatives.
Right.
They are helping once. They are helping each other. And that's why this in Thakkolam war, they helped. Helped the Rashtrakutas to win their Cholas. Similarly, on northern face also, in many wars, Gangas are supported, Rashtrakutas. Not only Gangas, the Dolambas and even Banas supported the Rashtrakutas to extend their kingdom beyond the Godavari River. And in the second phase also, they take the help of these Gangas and Nalambas and Banas. Once again, they went to north and occupied many areas.
Thank you for those insights, Dr. Krishnamurthy. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay, sir. Thank you.
And now to talk about the Begur stone is my guest, Anirudh Kanisetty. He is the researcher, a historian, and he's the author of a wonderful book, Lords of the Deccan. Anirudh, welcome to the history of Bangalore. I'm very happy to have you here. Now, I read this fascinating essay that you had written about the Begur stone. And if you look at the stone from a certain angle, it looks like the sculptor got really, really motivated and very, very busy. But you deconstructed that stone. Would you do that for us right now?
Thanks, Ramji. So there's a couple of things that are evident once you take a look at the stone. It does seem like there's a lot going on, but there's also very clearly two registers. There's an upper register where there's a bunch of text surrounding an individual wearing this gorgeous, what seems to be a feathered headdress. He's looking to the side, attended by a couple of women. And in the lower register, which is really perhaps the more interesting part of the stone, this is very chaotic, what's evidently a battle. There's people getting stabbed, there's bodies lying all over the place. And there's the same individual with the headdress charging towards the right, riding a horse, while somebody riding an elephant is also charging at him with a javelin in hand. The Begur hero stone considers warfare to be the utmost attainment. And that's very clearly what's depicted in the upper register, where this hero, apparently having died in battle, is now being attended by Apsaras. From a large body of medieval literature, that it was generally believed that young men, or just men in general who died in battle, would be carried up to heaven and attended by buxom women, something that seems to have been an eternal motivation for young warriors across the world.
Never heard of that.
And something that is still believed. I find the hero stone, it's an indication of the martial culture of this particular region of southern Karnataka. It tells us something interesting about what was going on politically at the time.
Speaking of which, Krishna Rao says that Bira Mahendra was Nolamba. Which way do you go? Nolamba or not?
I think the one that I lean towards is that it may have been a king of Vengi, which was a prosperous little coastal kingdom. And the reason why I think it might be a king of Vengi was because at the time, the Ganga kingdom embroiled in conflict with both the Rashtrakutas and the Chalukyas of Vengi. And I think a title of one of the Vengi kings, if I'm not wrong, it is probably Vijayaditya III, was Veera Mahendra. Again, we're not entirely sure if it's the same person, because Veera Mahendra just means, you know, the great valiant lord, practically anybody. But all these factors put together, I think, incline us towards thinking it was the king of Vengi.
I guess we'll never know. Thanks for being here, Anirudh. Let's get you back on the show. This is typical of what historians have to face when all they have for evidence is inscription stones recorded centuries ago, the interpretations of which could lead two historians in reasonably different directions. And coming up in our next episode, a fascinating dive into the discovery of first century Roman coins that we found in Bangalore, and what that meant to how much we understand of the history of the day. This has been so much fun. I am Ramji Chandran, and this is the History of Bangalore.